Hi, I'm Simon Smart from CPX, and you're listening to the Richard Johnson Lecture Podcast. In this episode, you'll hear Andy Crouch's 2022 lecture titled Disconnected: Why Technology Keeps Disappointing Us. Well, technology promises so much and truly has transformed our lives, but somehow it never quite delivers what we hope. Drawing on an older vision of human beings as heart, soul, mind, strength complexes designed for love, Andy Crouch makes the case for applying our scientific knowledge in a way that restores things that are in strangely short supply in our technological age: real connection, relationship, and hope.
Well, thank you very much, Justine. Thank you, Simon. Thank you to the whole staff and many others who have made this possible. And it is a great delight to finally be here with you. I've been looking forward to it ever since I said yes the first time, and have renewed my yes many times because I wanted to be with you. I knew I had a lot to learn. I've already learned a great deal from my first visit to Australia. And I hope we will learn some things together tonight. I want to start by reflecting on two paradoxically present emotions or sentiments that I think we feel when we consider technology in our own lives as well as in kind of the story that we're all part of. And the first is exhilaration, the great excitement that we feel when a new piece of technology or a new version of technology is showing up in our lives. I think maybe the most intense form is found in the form of an adolescent who has finally persuaded their parents to let them have a fill-in-the-blank. It can be a video game console, it can be a first cell phone or whatever. That delight of getting a new device, that sense that there's new possibilities opening up. And this is, I know not everyone feels this way. I spoke to someone just this week who said, I put off upgrading as long as I can. But that's not the dominant note in our society. Our journalists and media cover new releases of new devices, the possibilities of the next device, and we ourselves rehearse those stories to us. At least many of us do, including one person on this stage who is always downloading the latest beta of whatever's coming. And there's this sense of great excitement. And yet, shortly after procuring the thing, whatever it is, comes another feeling, surprisingly often, not every time, but surprisingly often, which maybe we could call a sense of doubt or possibly regret. The sense that it's not working out as well as I hoped. Now, it seems to me that when we look back over the very long history of innovation in the human story, which goes all the way back to the beginning of the human story, as far as we can tell, that we can easily imagine our distant ancestors feeling the exhilaration part. We, at least when we imagine the invention of the wheel, which always seems to be the go-to example at moments like this, we imagine those early humans kind of exulting in the wheel. We do not imagine them regretting the wheel. I really wish I hadn't gotten a wheel. I feel addicted to my wheel. I have no-wo-phobia, that's the fear of being without your wheel, or I'm missing sleep because of my wheel. I'm trying to cut down on my wheel use during Lent this year. Is it not really something that comes to mind? It doesn't seem that it actually attached itself in that way to these earlier innovations. There's something new happening, and it's not just the users who feel twinges of doubt or regret, but even the inventors. The woman who invented the Facebook like button, the button that allowed you to signal with a single bit of information your approval of some friend's post, actually invented a plugin for browsers that hides the entire newsfeed from your of Facebook. She no longer works for Facebook. Tony Fadell, who led the teams that invented the iPod and then the iPhone, told Fast Company in 2017, I wake up in cold sweats thinking, what did we bring to the world? It's the inventor of this device that almost all of us have, or we have a version of it, has brought untold wealth to his employer and to him. And he's not quite J. Robert Oppenheimer, I am become death, destroyer of worlds, but surprisingly close given that it doesn't seem to be a weapon. But I wake up in cold sweats thinking, what did we bring to the world? And when we honestly assess this story that we're very much in the middle of, and in some ways in the very early part of, I think, on the scale of human history, we have reason for doubt, if not regret. We uneasily contemplate the planetary toll of the systems we've built to procure the power we wield. And we wonder how much the resources and ecosystems of this beautiful and abundant, but also in certain ways, delicately balanced and fragile planet can bear of our demand for this kind of power that technology has unleashed. When we consider the value chain that brings our devices sealed in such beautiful ways to our hands, we can feel a little uneasy when we consider going back to the source, to the rare earths and minerals, the conditions required for the production of the raw materials, and wonder if we would want that job. And then we wonder what happens after we dispose, as we so quickly do, of these devices. Where do they go? What becomes of them? What landfills do they fill? And that's just the material layer of the technology, because even the seemingly completely virtual involves hidden costs from which we mostly are protected, if that's the right word, such as the legions of people who spend their days filtering our social media streams so that we do not see the brutality and exploitation and abuse that would otherwise fill our streams as people, as some human beings do, seek to fill the world with the worst of the world. And there's all these people working, not primarily in cities like this, but in other parts of the world, moderating the content. At what cost does that come? And then we also sense that even we who are the beneficiaries of this technology have some reason to wonder what toll it's taking on us. We are living through, I think this is so interesting, of course we've just lived through a great global pandemic, but it will be a footnote in history compared to the great public health epidemic of our time that afflicts most nations that have in any way been touched by technology. And it's the first epidemic in history not caused by an infectious agent. It's called metabolic syndrome. The combination of high blood pressure, pre-diabetes, overweight, that is the distinctive affliction of developed countries, taking untold years of life and health from people, and caused basically by the inactivity that our devices have made possible. And when you start raising these questions, people often respond in this way. They say, oh, you know, these questions have been raised about every innovation. Come on, we'll solve those problems. This is just a moral panic. We'll become accustomed to these new advances. People used to worry about the mental health effects of the novel. You know, does anyone worry? No middle marchophobia. Like I'm missing my novel. You know, and there were real concerns about the emotional effects of the novel, and we don't worry about that anymore. Silly person, don't worry about social media. If people want to be really highbrow and sophisticated, they go back to the Phaedrus, Plato's dialogue, in which Socrates tells the story of the god Thoth inventing writing and presenting it to the Egyptian king Thamos. And Thoth thinks this is going to be a great benefit to human beings. And Thamos says, yes, you are very clever. But once people can write, they won't need to remember. So while you're giving them a kind of ability to reminisce, you're taking away their ability to actually remember. And people will say, well, look, it turned out fine. We all write, don't we? Which we do. And we also don't remember anything. So Socrates was totally right. But this is offered as this sort of salve to our regrets. Oh, just hang on. Society will adjust. It'll all turn out all right. But in fact, there are any number of things that were perceived at the time as advances that we did not at all become accustomed to. And in fact, in certain extreme cases now would wholeheartedly repudiate things that were thought of as progress that we no longer would allow. To take a very trivial example, some of us in the room remember that people used to stop everything when the phone rang. The phone would ring. This was landlines. I realize this will be unfamiliar to some people, the idea. But the phone would ring, And no matter what the conversation was, no matter who the guest was at the dinner table, you just stopped and you ran to answer the phone. And people found this very distressing, but the phone wasn't going to keep ringing forever. You had to answer it. And everyone felt it wasn't right. And we eventually decided it really should be fixed. And so we invented voicemail, something that we're now moving on from to just texting everybody all the time, which probably is an improvement. But what voicemail did was allow us to sort of recalibrate the urgency of the phone. We didn't just get used to that. When was the last time a conversation of any importance was interrupted by someone's phone ringing and them just sort of neglecting you for the phone? It's much more rare now, isn't it, than it was back when there was no voicemail and when you had to answer. But that's a trivial example. 100 years ago, lecture halls like this one would have been filled with the most progressive and scientifically minded people celebrating the possibilities of eugenically eliminating defective human beings from the genetic lineage of the human race. This was absolutely mainstream progress made possible by allegedly scientific understanding of the human constitution and human possibility. And it's very hard to remember how mainstream it was, because after the horrors of Nazi Germany, we just systematically agreed to forget that any of us had ever supported that. But it was absolutely part of the story of progress. And today, none of us, and fortunately, almost no one in our world would endorse that kind of eugenic vision. I think we should take from this great caution and great hope. The great caution is that even things that are almost unanimously lauded as progress can turn out to be quite damaging. But the great hope is that we actually did turn the corner and did change course. And sometimes this change of course requires pure renunciation, as obviously it did with the eugenic dream. But it can also take the form of redesign, which is what happened when we added voicemail to this stack of technology, and thus diverted the urgency and distraction of certain kinds of phone calls. And that's what I want to prompt us to think about tonight. And I want to talk about both renunciation, but also redesign, because I think we need both. Let me define my terms just a little bit. When we say technology, what really are we talking about? Because often people will also say, well, we've always had technology. The wheel is technology, you know. And I think there's some truth to this, because human beings have always sought to extend our capabilities in the world through material things and eventually through kind of immaterial things like writing and language and so forth. And so we've always had tools. But 100 years ago or so, we started to use this other word, this relatively new word, a relatively recent coinage, this word technology. And we already had the word for tool, going back to the Greek word techne, that gives us the root of technology. But we decided we needed a new word. Why? I think because something changed in the kinds of material things we were using to extend our power in the world. And maybe I can put it this way, using this very famous quote from the science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, who said, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic." I think about 100 years ago, as we discovered the new sources of power and new sources of internal control, what we call the discipline of cybernetics, ultimately, and we had things that could operate on their own and operate with a kind of autonomy, we started to have things that operated very much in the way that we've always imagined magic would work. And this is different from tools. The philosopher Albert Borgmann, who has influenced me so much, talks about this new development in the story of human making as the rise of the device. And I like to use this distinction between a tool and a device. And a device is something that operates with a surprising degree of its own power and, in a way, its own will. It does things on its own without you having to operate it. And I think it's devices, used in this broad sense, not just your phone device, but anything that has this kind of property of internal power and internal self-control and responsiveness to its environment,
I think that's what we call technology. I don't think Clark would have said or could have said persuasively any sufficiently advanced tool is indistinguishable from magic. This past Christmas, one of my in-laws gave us a Kyocera ceramic knife. In the last 20 years, there's been huge breakthroughs in ceramics and the application of ceramics to many different activities, and one of them is the kitchen. And so there are these kitchen knives made of ceramic that you may have that are just unbelievably sharp and absolutely brilliant for cutting tomatoes, for example. But they're not magic. It's not a magic knife. But it is a very advanced tool. A hammer is a tool. A nail gun is a device. A nail gun has a kind of property of its own capability to act with minimal involvement from a human being. But of course, the nail gun is just a step on the way to a sufficiently advanced technology, which I think would be like a nail gun Roomba. Are you familiar with the Roomba, the robotic vacuum, right? So imagine you need to roof your house, right? Instead of going up there with a hammer that you have to use, or even a nail gun that you still have to hold and point in the general direction and go, right? You would just put your nail gun Roomba up on the roof, and you would stand down there, ideally with a beer, and you would just watch as, and it would just do the roof. Magical hammering. That's the vision of technology. Devices function under their own power, independently of us, though ideally, like the sorcerer's apprentice's broom, still at my behest and command. So when I say technology, I really want us to think about it not just as any old tool, but as the product of science, all the discoveries of science, plus a dream. And the dream is the dream of magic. The dream's the dream of escape. Francis Bacon, at the dawn of the Enlightenment, imagines what might happen if we could truly unlock the secrets of nature, though he uses rather more exploitative metaphors for what might happen as we discovered nature's secrets. And he says we would use this to relieve, to paraphrase in sort of modern language, to relieve the human estate. And by that he means our kind of embeddedness in suffering and illness, but also fatigue and exertion and toil. And if we could relieve ourselves of this, if we could escape from the suffering and effort that seems to be part of human life, that is what we would use our scientific knowledge for. That was Francis Bacon's dream. I think it's not just a dream of escaping from something, but escaping to something that now I'm seeing this word so everywhere I go in the world of technology, escaping to superpowers. There's a lot of things being sold these days. It's giving you superpowers. I was trying to download a little plugin for my presentation software, and they wanted to tell me how to have marketing superpowers, which I wasn't actually interested in that offer, but maybe it appeals to you. And that this idea of superpowers is that you can unlock a kind of cheat code to the universe, a way to circumvent the way we always got things done. Up until a very short time ago, all of life, all of work, proceeded basically at the scale and the pace of organic processes. The world was powered largely by digestion. But the financial, industrial, and computational revolutions seem to have unlocked superpowers that operated at a scale and a pace that we never could have imagined before. Escaping from suffering, escaping to superpowers, and in many, many respects, this has totally worked. Who can doubt that we experience far less of the forms of suffering that Francis Bacon attended to than he and his contemporaries did? Who can doubt that we have scales and pace available to us that no human generation has before? It has worked. The question is, has it worked out the way we expected? Because isn't it interesting that if I said, do you experience toil, fatigue, and exhaustion? I don't think you would say that you have been relieved of that part of the human estate, even though you would find it very hard to explain Zoom fatigue to your great-grandparents. Oh, I'm so tired at the end of this day on Zoom. Oh, well, why, honey? What's wrong? Well, I just sit there in front of a screen. And, well, like, are you working hard? Well, yes. Well, no. I mean, I'm just sitting there and talking with people and paying attention to little boxes on the screen. Well, that doesn't sound so bad. I mean, I have to go milk the cow now. And you really would have a hard time explaining Zoom fatigue, but you feel it. You feel it very deeply. It's very real, but quite unanticipated. It all works. Just doesn't work out in the way we thought. And then we also experience kinds of frustration that I think our great-grandparents didn't experience. Who among us has not been reduced to toddler-like levels of anger at a device whose magic is temporarily interrupted? Simon was experiencing it right before the talk as he realized we weren't going to be able to do the, you know, automatic question-asking thing. Because this is the essence of toddler's frustration. The toddler dream is that the world will magically work on my behalf, and when it doesn't, I get really mad. And I just cannot imagine our ancestors being that angry at the wheel when it went over something a little bumpy or whatever. What's gone wrong? I think we've been chasing the wrong dream. I think we've designed our devices actually quite poorly for what's best for us. And I am not anti-technology in any way. I have technology right in front of me. I'm using it to speak to you. I used it to get to this continent. I'm not anti-technology in the sense of wanting to just arbitrarily stop or roll back the clock to some imagined point in the past, or to forego technical or technological advances. I actually think we desperately need more advances. The glowing rectangle is basically an accommodation to the interaction affordances of computers. It's just the best way we have right now to interact with the computational power that we design. But we need to advance far beyond the glowing rectangle. There's no reason we have to stop at screens. I would love for us to get beyond screens in terms of the primary way we interact with these computational devices that do have all kinds of usefulness. So I'm all for advance. But if we're not going to keep going in the current direction, which seems to produce just as much regret as exhilaration, what are we going towards? What should we redirect ourselves toward?
We'll be back to the lecture after a short break.
Today, there are over 40 million people trapped in slavery. That's more than ever before in human history. We are International Justice Mission, and we believe we can end slavery in our lifetime. Together with our local partners, RJM rescues and restores victims, brings criminals to justice, and strengthens justice systems. To find out more, visit rjm.org.au. International Justice Mission. Until all are free.
And now, back to the lecture.
I have found myself drawn back to one of the central ideas of one of the world's most influential wisdom traditions, the Jewish and then Christian view of the world, that at its very heart, in both its Jewish and Christian expressions, gives us, I think, a really powerful clue to who we are and what technology could be for us, or what we could put all of this knowledge we have of the world towards that would be better for us. It comes in the form of something that to faithful Jews is known as the Shema Yisrael. It's this short reading from what we call the Book of Deuteronomy that is posted on the doorpost of every observant Jewish home. And it says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength." And when Jesus of Nazareth was asked, what's the greatest commandment? Which I think is in a way an ancient and Jewish way of asking, what is the essence of human flourishing? He did something Jesus almost never did. He gave an entirely predictable answer. It's the most predictable thing Jesus ever said was, well, you know what it says. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul. And then he does something a little unpredictable. He adds a term, all your mind, which is not in the Shema in the same way, and your strength. Heart, soul, mind, strength. I actually think this is a very, very compelling account of what it is actually to be a person at our best. I've come to think of it this way. We, as human beings, as human persons, are heart, soul, mind, strength complexes designed for love. You are a heart, soul, mind, strength complex designed for love. I am a heart, soul, mind, strength complex designed for love. A human person is not a mind without a heart. You're also not a brain without a body. You are not a body without a soul. Nor were you ever meant to be a soul without a body, in spite of certain Platonic distortions of the Christian tradition. You're all four, and they interact without being entirely melded. They're separate. Heart, desire that leads to will, emotion that draws you toward the good. Soul, depth of self, I guess, at least. That sense that I'm more than the surface. There's something within me that is uniquely me, that perhaps answers to a unique spiritual reality in the cosmos, perhaps. Mind, our ability to rationally think our way through the world, even though we often feel our way through the world. We can engage our mind and bring that in as well to orient ourselves and interpret the world that we find ourselves in. And then strength, which I think invites us to remember our physical constitution. A few years ago, I got to meet a guy named Steve Merland, who's quite a remarkable trainer of the human body, though also actually of the heart, soul, and mind of athletes. He's worked with a number of professional sports teams in the U.S. If you've ever used the ABC ladder, which is the agility, balance, coordination ladder that is used in field sports like soccer, where you jump in and out of this ladder, he's the one who invented that and patented it. And I learned from Steve what you can learn from any number of physiology courses, but I learned it from Steve in a kind of compelling way about the three planes of motion of the human body. The human body moves and torques through three planes: the sagittal plane, which is kind of front and back, the frontal plane or coronal plane, which is, we can think of as side to side, and then all that movement happens because we transmit rotational forces up through the core of the body through the transverse plane. And Steve Marlin's great insight in training athletes was that many athletes don't train all three planes. They train, if you're a pitcher, you train for movement just in the sagittal plane. That's a baseball thing. That's American. I don't know if that works. I'm sure it works. It's very unfair that you all know American culture and I know nothing about AFL or whatever, but so I'm going to stick with baseball. And he said you can actually walk into a room of athletes who have trained for too long on just their sport, and you can actually see in their bodies that their bodies have adapted to movement in one plane. But he said an adapted body is not an adaptable body. It's more susceptible to injury. So he pioneered these incredible techniques to train athletes to move in all three planes, because that's how the human body is meant to work. And I both think that's interesting in its own right, because think about our technological world and how much opportunity does it afford many of us to operate in all three planes. When I'm in a room like this, I sometimes ask people, and I could do it right now, how many of you in the course of your day, most of your day is spent moving through the three planes of motion of the human body? Wow, a very small number. Now, that is not necessarily representative. There are many jobs and occupations that do involve that, both paid and unpaid. But what you'll find is, speaking in great generalities, they tend to be lower status jobs and less technological jobs, because those two go together in our society. And the more high status and the more technological your job, the more it is likely that you use no planes. You are a T-Rex typing. So it's illuminating just for inviting us to remember, up till a blink of an eye ago, almost all human vocations involved movement in all three planes. And now we're pinioned to a mode of existence that ignores the multidimensional reality of our bodies. But then I also think it metaphorically works so well to ask how many of the things we do invite us to heart, soul, mind, and strength. These four dimensions, you could think of it, of being a person. The more technological your life is, the less likely it is that it engages all of those at once. And then there is this word in the Shema that Jesus redoubles on. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength. This word all to me is this invitation to imagine a fullness of capability, a fullness of emotional depth and resonance, a fullness of soul, a kind of deep sense of self and self in relation to the ultimate, a fullness of mind, of keen rational capability, and a fullness of strength. Because if I'm going to love with all of that, that sort of implies that I'm going to need to develop all these capabilities to their maximum extent, to be able to offer them up to God and perhaps to neighbor in love. And how much does our technology develop us? It gives us great proxy abilities. The Roomba vacuums without me. The Roomba nail gun, I imagine, will roof without me. But I will be left holding a beer, which, you know, not all bad, but not developmental. And this is not true of tools. the tools that human beings used involved us deeply in the world. But our devices disengage us. And in the disengagement comes a diminishment. And all this, by the way, is, according to this wisdom tradition, intended for love. Love is at the very heart of the design of persons. And it's also true, aside from the intrinsic value of love and the intrinsic value of the others we are called to love, and perhaps the capital O other that we are made to love, it's also true that you will never develop allness of heart, soul, mind, and strength unless you are loved, supported by love, because developing that is a vulnerable thing. To develop your strength is a vulnerable thing, let alone to develop your heart or your mind, let alone your soul. And this is so distant from the current dominant vision that is driving technological advance. We're seeing, and I think I'm channeling a writer named Mike Sakasas here, in our time, the extraordinary spectacle of one of the world's most powerful and wealthy men who could purchase or pursue any pleasure or joy that he wished, who longs so much to escape from this embodied reality into a virtual one that he has renamed his entire company after the quest to transcend heart, soul, mind, strength reality and create a virtual world, a meta world. And there are many things you could say about that, but just related to this design for love, think about this. In that virtual world that you are invited to enter through the Meta Inc. Portal, every single interaction of any kind will be a transaction. We arrive in this world, this actual world that you and I are in right now, and discover immeasurable abundance that is just sheer gift. We didn't ask for it, couldn't make it. Sheer gift, including our own bodies, knit together, as the psalmist says, in secret, mysteriously, and fearfully and wonderfully made. But we will arrive in that metaverse as entirely manufactured entities without a shred of gift. And in that virtual world, you will be far from a heart, soul, mind, strength complex. Your body, by design, is excluded, except in a sort of animated imitation. Your soul, by sheer inattention and ignorance, really, is neglected. Your depth of desire, your heart, all those things that at your best you long for, will be flattened into a series of consumer appetites for consumable pleasures. And I doubt that in the end you'll even feel that the virtual world develops your mind. In such a world, you might possibly find certain satisfactions, but you'll never find love. So much for the critique. We've got to redesign. We've got to redesign. And it's not too late to redesign. All of us, I would think, in a room like this, have at some point tasted true heart, soul, mind, strength activity. I'm here in Sydney, so I'm thinking about surfing, which is not something I have really ever done. I've snorkeled, I've paddled, I have not surfed. But some of you have, and some of you have told me what it's like. And when you talk to surfers about surfing, what you hear about is heart, soul, mind, and strength, and allness of that. For me, it's the bicycle. A real human technical achievement, the bicycle, not something that just was in the world already. It's all kinds of ingenuity of human making. And when I'm on my bike, and I ride 20 miles a day, every day when I can, I experience heart, soul, mind, strength activity. Why couldn't we ask that of our most advanced technique, techne? Maybe we need a new name for it beyond technology, because technology is too tied up in this dream of magic and escape and superpowers. But couldn't technology, couldn't all that we know of the world, give us opportunities to actually experience fullness of heart, soul, mind, and strength? I think while we wait for that redesign, all of us need to be redesigning just the most, kind of at any moment that we can, the most basic activities of our days, to add more movement, to add more emotion, to add more cognition, and maybe somehow to add more soul. I started doing this during the pandemic, probably many of us did. I realized I was completely burnt out on Zoom, and I thought, any one-on-one meeting, I already know what my coworkers look like, so I don't really need to see them, and I could walk while we talk. So I started taking many, many meetings, walking around my neighborhood on my phone, and found that actually the conversations were far more generative than they had been before. When I was out moving through the world, I started going outdoors first thing in the morning, every day, about 5 years ago, before the pandemic, because I realized the first thing I was doing when I got up in the morning after making my tea, which is a dependency I will not give up, but I'd make my tea, and even before it was done steeping, I would be picking up my phone for whatever urgency and outrage it had to send me that day. And I thought, this cannot possibly be the best way to start my day. So I decided, before I pick up the phone, I'm going to go out of doors. I've been doing it even here where I'm staying in a kind of upper floor of a hotel, but I just take the elevator down before I turn on any glowing rectangle and step out just even for a moment into the world where I'm actually quite small. And I feel a kind of life return rather than a kind of compulsion that my phone used to lure me into. So there are these steps all of us can take right now to add heart, soul, and mind and strength to many of the things we do, but really ultimately we've got to redesign. Steve Jobs, the founder of Apple Computer, in this famous and beautiful little video that he happened to be captured in, had this phrase, the computer is a bicycle for the mind. I think that's a beautiful vision. I don't think it's what it's actually turned out to be. I think the computer is more like a self-driving car for the mind. It's kind of going somewhere, we're not sure it's reliable, and it's definitely driving on its own, and we're along as passengers. It's a device, it's too much of a device. I think we should ask, can we use these computational devices much more in tandem with human development, with human skill? And then, of course, we need not a bicycle for the mind, but also a bicycle for the heart. The soul, and like an actual bicycle. A bicycle for heart, soul, mind, strength complexes designed for love. And we actually have a template for this. We actually have high technology that functions in this way, and we actually have a name for it. So it dawned on me a few years ago, this is actually what we call instruments. So you think, my wife is a scientist, she's a physicist, and my wife uses all kinds of technology in her work, but they are scientific instruments that are not devices. They're much more like tools in a way, except that they're just very, very sophisticated in their constitution and composition. But they're used by a person, a scientist, or really by persons together, because all science is done quite collaboratively. And those persons bring heart to their science, because it actually is beautiful and elegant, and you're motivated by the beauty of what you're discovering. They bring soul, whether or not they may identify as people of faith or religion. There's a kind of depth of self required to be a great scientist. They, of course, bring mind, but it's actually also quite embodied when you're doing experimental physics, which is what Catherine does, and many other kinds of experimental work. And the instrument is there not to replace or displace the person, but to develop and hone and focus the capabilities of the person so that we can go to the very edge of what we know and discover more about this beautiful and abundant world. Medical instruments used by physicians and clinicians who bring great skill, great heart, really need to bring great soul to the care of other persons in physical, medical distress, and they use instruments, but the instruments are not devices that just operate by themselves. And then, of course, musical instruments, which can be very high tech. My favorite one from the 20th century is the two turntable arrangement of the DJs use. Because think about this, the turntable kind of is the ultimate device, just plays music, you don't have to play. But somebody says, that's not enough, I want to make something with this. And they turned a device into an instrument. This is what we need. One thing I love about this is it gives us something to do besides complain. It gives us a really massive and challenging agenda for, in a sense, the human race, for the whole work of technology, and all of us have a part to play, whether it's as consumers and what we ask for and what we pay for, or as engineers or as supervisors or as people who shape the imaginations of others. We could be seeking a different kind of tech, one that would leave us with less regret. So I have a few more thoughts, though I am very near the end of the time that I was given. So let me see if I can race through them. I hope it's helpful to add one more thing. The main thing I hope we leave thinking about is how would we redesign? But there are some things we need to renounce. And I do think we also need to consider a kind of renunciation at this moment in the technological story. In some ways, it seems to me that what we have been pursuing, the best word I have come up to use for it, is magic, which is the pursuit of shallow power. Power in the world that does not require us to become different in any way, that does not require us to grow or mature, just to control. Ultimate leisure or ultimate efficacy, but no growth and no love. That's the sort of this shallow dream of magic. And that shallow power stands in contrast to something you could call deep power. Because there is a deep power at work in the human story that often leads to the best in the human story. I think about C.S. Lewis's beautiful phrase, the deeper magic from before the dawn of time. The power we feel, given especially where we are tonight, in the presence of art. Art that's not just disposable, mediated bids for attention, but art that requires attention and then rewards attention. There's a deep power in art that is not there in what we often call media. The power that still draws people to old buildings, the kind of buildings that were built with a sense of reverence, whether or not they were religious in function, the kind that were built with a holy indifference to utility or utilitarianism. There's a deep power that actually matters a great deal in the human story, and it seems to me almost indisputable that as we've pursued shallow power, we have lost hold of deep power. Jesus talked about this. What is it worth gaining the world if you forfeit your soul? And at least one way to read that is as a warning about the pursuit of shallow power at the expense of what ultimately matters. And you might think that the logical implication would be, well, so don't pursue shallow power, pursue deep power. But there is actually a long warning in the human story that deep power is not something you can pursue. It can only be safely wielded, if we can say it that way, as a gift. You can't just grab the reins. And instead, our pursuit needs to be a third kind of power. And I'm getting this phrase from my friend, the writer Alan Jacobs. I love this phrase. Not superpowers, not shallow power, but what Alan has called our proper powers. What if we, in a sense, contented ourselves, but also focus ourselves on the pursuit of proper powers? The things that really are within our appropriate reach, rather than the dream of superpowers. This, I think, is what the Shema calls us to, because heart, soul, mind, and strength are our proper constitution as human beings. And proper powers, the power to walk with someone, the power to look someone in the eye, the power to listen to another voice and hear something that wasn't said. These are, in fact, the gateway, with much mystery, to deeper power. The power to bring about the kind of change in the world that is actually needed, first of all, in us. I'm condensing, because to quote another saying of Jesus that every speaker in the Christian tradition needs in front of them, I have much more to say to you, but you cannot bear it now. I'll end with this. To pursue our proper powers, I think I know why we don't want to. Why we would rather escape from suffering and escape to superpowers. Because to actually take up this invitation to heart, soul, mind, and strength is to embrace vulnerability. Not the vulnerability that Bacon attended to, the meaningless suffering that we should do everything in our power to eliminate from the human story, but the proper vulnerability of opening ourselves up to emotion that we might fear to feel, to opening ourselves up to the possibility of a soul in which deep calls to deep, even the training of strength involves a kind of vulnerability, and it turns out even our minds are not the instruments of control we imagine, but the training of the mind involves a kind of deep humility. And here too, Jesus has something to say. Save your life, he says, and you'll actually lose it. Those who seek to save their lives will lose it. What is the story of technology to date, if not a vast global attempt to save our lives, to feel like we're really living, in which we find ourselves simultaneously losing so much that we valued and wanted to save? But Jesus also says, lose your life and you will save it. Give up the quest for control. Give up the dream of magic, and you will actually find that everything you need is there. Seek first the kingdom, Jesus says, and all these other things will be added to you as well. G.K. Chesterton said that Christianity has largely not been tried and found wanting, but has been found difficult and not been tried. And for about 100 years ago, now we've tried technology. The dream of easy everywhere, the dream of escape, the dream of superpowers, the dream of magic. And we found it diminishing and disappointing in ways we never would have imagined. But on the other side of that disappointment, and the redesign and renunciation that must follow, we just might discover that all we have ever dreamed of can still be found. Thank you all very much for your time and attention tonight.
You've been listening to the 2022 Richard Johnson Lecture delivered by Andy Crouch. Andy is a partner for theology and culture at Praxis, an organization that works as a creative engine for redemptive entrepreneurship. He's also an author of many titles. His latest one, The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological Age. Please also check out our other podcast, Life and Faith, which is a weekly conversation about, well, life and faith and the complexity of belief in the 21st century. You can find that wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to know more about CPX, our website is publicchristianity.org.